Mayo, I saw a tweet yesterday that struck a nerve with me, and then my opinion seemed to strike a nerve with other people, where you know the back button that appears in the upper left corner on your iPhone when you're switching between apps? Like, for instance, if you're in the Messages app and you tap a link that takes you to Safari, in Safari, you'll see a back button in the upper left corner that can take you back to Messages. The tweet said that that feature should be removed and that nobody ever uses it and that it's redundant because you can just swipe between apps with a home bar at the bottom of your iPhone. That is a sentiment I very much agree with. The back button, for me, well, for one, if you use a Pro Max phone, reaching up to tap that back button is like impossible. Like,
it's in a different state. Yeah,
it's so far away. And then as someone, too, who takes a lot of screenshots, having a back button in the upper left corner is just kind of ugly. It kind of ruins the vibe of the screenshot.
It is probably one of the ugliest buttons they have in the operating system as well. And it like pushes the clock up into the ear, into the corner even more than normal. Yeah, because I'm pretty sure that feature rolled out before the notch phones were here. So it's like the back button's more designed for the thing where the time used to be in the center, right?
I want to say it was like an iOS 7 thing, maybe?
Maybe 8 or 9.
Eight, I feel like somewhere around there.
Yeah, before, I don't think it was 7, but a couple years after that, yeah. Before the iPhone 10, I'm pretty sure. And obviously with the iPhone, as well as it looking a bit weird design-wise, functionality-wise, it's a bit redundant because you can just swipe on the home indicator at the bottom, and if you do a horizontal swipe, you can switch between apps very, very quickly. And it's very fluid and very nice. And that's what I do. I'm sure that's what you
Absolutely.
Do. I'm sure that's what most people listening to the show do. But I don't think it's very common action. Like, I don't see, anecdotally, in the real world, very many people that, even if they know about the fact you can swipe horizontally on that bar, do they remember to actually do it? Like, it's way more comfortable for people just to swipe up to go to the home screen and then just click on the icon they want. And so that little back button probably does actually have a fair amount of usage in terms of people clicking on it. I also think it's there just as an indicator to like signify, yes, you have switched application. So, you know, like if you're in like a
Instagram, true.
You click on the link, instead of it being a web view, like an integrated like Safari web view, you know, inside like view controller, like inside the app, you've actually switched applications. So it does give a bit more of an indication of that for people that might get lost. So that might be another reason why they won't get rid of it. But the raw fact is, I think more people click the button than know to swipe left and right on the indicator. The iPhone 10 gesture system has changed almost not at all since it came out in 2017. And that's mostly because they nailed it. Like, it's a really good system.
It's so good.
It's very intuitive to open apps, close apps, and even get to multitasking, which is relatively complicated to like verbalize because there's not like a separate action you do. You're just swiping up. You're just kind of swiping up more slowly, and it kind of uses the momentum or velocity of your finger to work out that, oh, you're not actually going all the way home. You're just kind of waiting. And when you first adapt like the iPhone 10 originally, you would have to like be very particular about swiping up just slowly enough so that the multitasking appears. But once you get in the rhythm of it, it becomes like second nature to just like hold and then hold for a second, and then boom, the multitasking arrives. And they have some really nice details where if you open an app from the home screen, you can close the app before it maximizes if you're quick enough. So like if you click on the icon and then immediately swipe down, it doesn't have to get to full screen for it to carry on recognizing you want to close it. And you can go, if you open it slightly and then immediately like pull up to the right hand side, you can go straight into multitasking. Like, it's a continuous action. It's not like discrete gestures. So whatever you're doing, you can switch to the multitasking. Like, you can catch the icon as it's expanding and pull it to the side, and the multitasking trays will appear. So it's a really well thought out system and pretty dynamic. The more advanced gesture is the thing at the bottom where you can go left and right. And you don't even have to go precisely left and right, because you can kind of go like in an arc and it will like open the next icon. You can bring it back down and maximize it again. Or you can like change your mind and go to the middle and it will come out to that tray. So if you're like a more advanced user, it feels really nice and fluid. I think most regular people, though, they just don't, for whatever reason, it doesn't internalize to them that they can swipe left and right and switch between apps. Or they just don't remember what the previous app they were in. Like, they don't have that like back stack of history in their head very well. So people like going home. And I see this in my family, right? Like, this thing annoys me so much. I've told my mom so many times, you can swipe left and right on that thing to go back to the previous app. She never remembers. And I've seen her, like, you know, she'll have an app open in a folder on the home screen, switch to an app. She'll swipe up, go to the home screen, close the folder, change page, open the second app, you know, find the bit of text, copy it, swipe up again, close, go back to the second page, open the folder, click on the app, and then finally paste it. And it's like infuriating, because you can just literally swipe left and right like in one go. and do it so much more quickly. But there are some things that, for whatever reason, you know, it's weird alchemy of human brains, people just don't want to figure out. And so that's why things like the visible on-screen battle button do have a, you know, have a use. Like, visual affordances do matter. Even for me, sometimes, you know, I see that bat button in the top corner. I'm like, oh yeah, that was the previous app I was in. I don't necessarily click on the bat button. I just use that as a reminder to swipe on the indicator and go back to the previous app. So it has value. I do wish it looked a bit prettier, though, at the very least.
You know what I just thought, and we'll talk about this a little bit later too, is maybe when they get rid of the iPhone SE and the home button and all the phones are on this modern notch or dynamic island design, they can revisit removing the back button. Maybe. Maybe that's why they're keeping it around.
It's a possibility, yeah.
I think the primary interaction most people have with the home bar at the bottom and the multitasking interface in general is swiping up and then closing all of their apps. The long-running practice that infuriates many of us.
One improvement they could do, if they still want to keep a visual affordance on screen, move the button from the top left to the bottom left. Like, put the name of the previous app in the bottom left corner when you're in that context. Yeah. And then you could, even if it could just like be an arrow to like indicate you still have to swipe, even if it's not necessarily tapping it. Because like you said earlier, especially on the bigger phones, the top left corner is like the worst place to put a button that you have
to click on. It's impossible. Yeah. Anyway, some more rumors, some more news about Apple's plans for a smart display of some sort. So our colleague Felipe had a report outlining the most interesting thing being that the new home accessory product will have a square-ish display. So like all of the mock-ups that we've seen, the renderings have been of an iPad-shaped screen like attached to a HomePod. What this report is suggesting is that it'll be shaped like a square. And I don't fully understand why. Why Apple feels the need to rock the boat and not just use the iPad form factor for this. And Felipe also says it'll have a built-in camera that works with Face ID or FaceTime and other video conferencing apps. Support hand gestures from a distance, which could be useful for if you're in the kitchen and you're cooking and you need to control the smart display one way or the other. But the big thing, again, that stands out to me is the squarish display design. Because especially if you're going to be able to do FaceTime on a square display doesn't sound particularly like a pleasant experience.
I mean, maybe it's like a big square and then the FaceTime is like on a, like the, you know, like split screen. You're like, you split screen and then you still see your like widgets and stuff on the left and you have like a portrait FaceTime on the right hand side. I think there's a merit to it. And because a big part of this kind of product, I think, is like kitchen use, right?
And yeah.
Most people, I know in America you guys have some big kitchens sometimes, but I feel like at least in the UK, the average countertop space for kitchen is not very much. Like, you know, once you put your actual cooking appliances on there isn't that much spare space to put another device. I'm quite lucky. My kitchen's quite big, but even then I've got like a slow cooker, not a slow cooker, air fryer in there now. That takes up space. Like, you know, I have like the cooking board and the microwave and stuff. There's not that many spots where I could feel like I've got like one spot left where I could put a smart display product. And if it's super big, then it's not going to fit. So if you go for a squarer design, maybe it's like square and then, you know, like a kind of big HomePod mini shape on the bottom of it. So it's that kind of size. It at least gives it more opportunity to fit into different places. Than if it's some like massive thing. You still need to be a relatively big screen so you can see it when you're on the other side of the room and stuff. But I can understand why it's not necessarily going for like a landscape form factor. If anything, I think going more portrait, it'd be better and like upright. But I can kind of get away with the square thing. And it also helps them visually distinguish it from iPads, right? Because
that's true.
Some of the selling point of this is going to be like, you know, you don't just want to have an iPad on a dock in your kitchen. You need to have this new thing which offers these specific benefits optimized for the experience and then like the 10-foot away user interface. You know, it might have more like widget focus rather than app focus. So by making it like a physically different shape, it does help differentiate it from the current options, which is just like people just hold their phone up in a vertical dock or they put an iPad in there or something. So I can kind of see the appeal of it. And although it does maybe mean that like, the biggest risk is that it's so different in shape that then it becomes like a new platform. So like you don't get app compatibility, right?
Right.
Like
yeah.
You kind of want to be able to take advantage of the app store. So you know, however many millions of units the home division of Apple sells, it's clearly dwarfed by iPads and iPhones, right? And so you don't want to have like a Vision Pro situation if you don't have to. Maybe with a square display, they could even just have like iPhone apps blown up and made really big potentially. And maybe not even iPad apps, because I do think you want the controls to be quite large, because you just want to like have very imprecise stabbing at it with your finger or maybe hand gestures and stuff. Like, you don't necessarily want the information density or the sidebars and, you know, all that gumph that you get on iPad apps. So they can maybe make it work with iPhone apps alone, or some kind of hybrid.
Or tvOS apps of some sort. My thinking on this all along has been it'll be some sort of combination of tvOS apps and iPad apps, maybe even sprinkled in with some sort of like Vision OS design tweaks of some sort.
I mean, the tvOS like visual style is kind of Vision OS-esque, right? It's a lot more rounded. There's a lot more like blurs and stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But I think tvOS looks better than iPad, like just visually, you know.
Yeah.
It has a lot more like character to it. It looks nice. Yeah.
But it comes down to what exactly you're going to be using something like this for. If you're going to put it in the kitchen, you probably want more iPad-focused apps. You want recipe apps. You want Safari. You want things that allow you to put up information and just look at it, not necessarily like streaming TV apps and games that we have on the Apple TV. And then Mark Gurman also had a report this week outlining that this will be the first product that runs Home OS, which he says will be built on top of tvOS, and that he ultimately expects the two platforms to be combined one way or the other. And he also specifically clarifies that this squarish smart home product that Felipe reported on, this lower end HomePod with a screen product, is different than the higher end robotic arm HomePod hodgepodge thing that follows you around. Like, those two things are different products. So Apple's planning the lower end cheaper version and the robotic arm version that I think he says is 2026 at the earliest.
And that's the $1,000 price point one. Yeah.
Hopefully $1,000. Yeah. So two separate products at very different price points. I don't think, other than the robotic arm, we've heard a compelling story about how they'll be different.
Yeah, at least with what we know right now, it's still a bit unclear about the appeal of spending $1,000 on that thing. But I am reassured that this one that we're talking about is not that. So yes, it can be much more lower market. And they can then go, they've got more license to go a bit crazy and pop off with some crazy robotic thing if they want to, even if it won't be very impactful in terms of ending up selling sell through. Like, if they were only doing the $1,000 one, that'd be a huge strategy blunder. So sounds like they're going for a two-tiered approach, which is much more amenable. I mean, this lower end one might still be really expensive, but at least it'll be more in the at least it won't be four digits, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, maybe the $1,000 one will be $999, so then there's three digits for you.
And Gurman called out, like, it will run apps like Calendar, Notes, and the Home app and stuff. So yeah, you can kind of see where the appeal is, what kind of activity and tasks, and unifying with Apple TV at some point with the new like Home OS thing would be really desirable, because I think it's kind of insane that the Apple TV doesn't have a Home app.
Yep. Like,
the only way to control your accessories, so the Apple TV, is to use your voice with Siri, which does work, but it feels crazy to me, like, the home screen of doesn't have like widgets on there or like accessories. You have to open that like tiny little menu thing by holding down the button, and then it kind of pops up a couple of your favorite scenes and stuff. Like, why is there not a dedicated Home app? And it probably just comes down to a matter of like resource allocation. If they've got more products all running the same operating system in the same UI, then they can all share in the benefits of common shared work.
I'm just very glad for at least one of these products to be released, because I think we've been talking about Apple's potential iPad HomePod combination device for like years at this point. I'm just excited to see something hit the market.
Happy Hour this week is brought to you by Shopify. Check them out at shopify.com/happyhour. Nobody does selling better than Shopify. It's the home of the number one checkout system in the world. Now, Chance, let's talk about the time when we used Shopify at 95 Mac. We sold wallpapers, right?
Yeah, we used Shopify to sell custom wallpapers to readers, and it really did make it incredibly easy to set things up and get going, because we wanted our focus to be on the content and the end product that we were giving to our readers. And using Shopify allowed us to put that first. Then when we were ready to launch, we were able to do so with Shopify very easily. And then for our readers too, Shopify made the checkout process incredibly seamless. So in just a few clicks, people could complete the checkout process and have immediate access to the content. So it gave the best possible experience to us as the creators and to our readers. And that is always our goal.
Yep. And I've also sold stuff before as an indie developer directly online and kind of coded the checkout system all by hand. And even though I had the know-how to do it, on reflection, it was so much work and hassle that really wasn't justified. Whereas what I love about Shopify is that it's so simple and it has everything you need in one place. So if you hit the jackpot and get big, you aren't stranded waiting for a development team to build out all the functionality. Shopify just has it there ready for you. So upgrade your business and get the same checkout that we used with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/happyhour, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/happyhour now to upgrade your selling today. That's shopify.com/happyhour. Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring the show. Happy Hour this week is also brought to you by Oracle. AI might just be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive at OCI at oracle.com/happyhour. That's oracle.com/happyhour. oracle.com/happyhour. Thanks to Oracle for sponsoring the show.
Couple of Apple Vision Pro rumors this week. So first, the ALEC reports that Apple has ordered samples of displays for probably what's going to be the next non-Pro Apple Vision headset. And the report says that the samples are in the 1500 to 1700 pixels per inch range, which is around half that of Vision Pro. I think this aligns with some other previous reporting about how Apple can get the cost of Apple Vision Pro lower. One of the most expensive components of Vision Pro are the screens. I go back and forth on this because the screens are also the best part about using Vision Pro.
They're like the best selling point of it as well.
They're so good. Yeah. They're so high pixel density. I still just can't get over the fact that those things are like so close to your eyeballs and the experience and the resolution is so good. Totally understand that they have to make a compromise to get the prices lower, right? And I don't doubt that one of the quickest and easiest ways to do that is by reducing the quality of the displays. But cutting the resolution in half, that sucks.
It depends how much cheaper they can get it, right?
Right, like, yeah, that's another factor.
They're competing with $500 Meta headsets at the low end, which are now they even sell a $399 one, right, with the Meta 3S or whatever that they announced just last week. If they can use these kind of half resolution OLED displays, which is still gonna be better quality than the Meta ones, but they can get, you know, $700, $900, then it's probably more justified. If this is gonna be like the $2,000 price point has been floated around and the quality's like halved, then it's kind of icky still. So the jury's out. They also might just be testing these other screens as something else. Maybe they what they're going to use in the home accessory. You know, like it doesn't necessarily say they're destined for the Vision Pro, but when it's a screen that's high resolution, it's hard to see what else they're going to put it in other than, headset displays.
Like you said, the qualifying disclaimer on all of this is it depends on how low the price gets, right? I would be fine with it if it gets to the closer to the Meta Quest 3S pricing. But if this is the mid-range, the $1,999 or even $2,500 quote-unquote cheaper version of Apple Vision Pro, then this is that reducing the display quality that much will be a misstep.
Yeah, I feel like in time and the short term, like a couple of years, they should be able to get the current Vision Pro spec at $2,500. You know what I mean? Like, So I don't think that the Vision Pro is always going to be a $3,500 starting price device. That's just what they could do in 2024. That price has to come down a bit, and they have to do an even cheaper model still. So hopefully, in the viewing distance of the near future, there'll be like a two-tier strategy where both models are cheaper, and the higher model can still retain almost everything about the model right now that makes it good.
For the Vision Pro itself, Ming-Chi Kuo reported last week that Apple is planning an M5 update for the Vision Pro for next year, featuring Apple Intelligence support, sounds like just a spec bump update. I know we've heard from both Quo and Gurman that Apple has kind of shelved its work on a next generation Vision Pro in favor of the lower end version. So my expectation based on this reporting too is that the only real change we'll see to Vision Pro within the next couple of years is this update to the M5.
Yeah, Quo kind of says that in his article. He says it basically resembles the same as the first one. It's mostly a chip spec bump, which is kind of going rogue on its own because some people have pitted the timeline for the high-end Vision Pro to be nothing, right? And
yeah,
they were going to focus solely on the cheaper model. So the fact there's going to be any spec bump at all is Quo kind of putting his head on the line there a bit.
The emphasis on Apple Intelligence, I can't tell if that's just Quo.
That's padding, editorializing, yeah, right? Yeah.
Padding the report to hit the word count. But because the current Vision Pro has an M2 chip, which is theoretically capable of running Apple Intelligence. We have no details from Apple about the story about Apple Intelligence on the Vision Pro. We have seen some evidence to indicate that Apple is working on or at least testing Apple Intelligence on the current Vision Pro. But as I think we talked about relatively recently, the baseline for what Vision Pro is doing at any given moment is just so much higher than the baseline of any other Apple product, where it's not out of the question that even though it has the M2 chip and enough RAM, it's just technically not enough to run Vision Pro.
Like so much of the RAM is taken up already doing
it. Yes, exactly.
Day-to-day task. It's not out of the question. I think I would be slightly upset if it can literally do none of it. Like maybe it can do some of the features and all of the features. Like it's obviously going to be strained and not great. But if an M1 iPad can do it, kind of feel like the M2 in the Vision Pro maybe could do it maybe. Like it doesn't feel unrealistic that it could do anything, but clearly if you've got better hardware, you've got more headroom, it's gonna be a lot nicer of an experience. And the other thing between pushing off the M2 is the M3 and beyond use Apple's new GPU architecture, which includes like hardware ray tracing support and all the other stuff. Feels like that'd be pretty beneficial to the Vision Pro, which is entirely, you know, GPU dependent.
Yeah.
So the fact that like it was kind of a shame that the way the scheduling worked out, the Vision Pro got lumped with the M2 when it seems like the new GPU architecture could have real big benefits for like modeling, rendering 3D models in your environment and having all the light reflections work and stuff. So if they can get a spec bump out, it'd be great.
Third and final Vision Pro thing this week, Juno, the third party YouTube app for Vision Pro developed by Christian Selig, the creator of the former once great Reddit client Apollo, has been pulled from the App Store at the request of Google. Essentially, what Juno did is just put a very nice Vision OS designed wrapper around YouTube.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Google, for whatever reason, still was not a fan of this, even though Juno didn't strip out ads, it didn't fundamentally change the YouTube experience. There was no harm to the YouTube business from Juno. The argument around Reddit and Apollo is completely separate, and I think maybe Reddit had some more basis in their argument, even though they went about their battle with Christian in a really bad and ugly way, but they had a basis for what they were complaining about.
What I would say is Reddit had an API that was open access.
Yes.
And obviously people made business off it, like Apollo. Then Reddit changed the API terms and made those businesses unviable. YouTube has never officially supported this kind of thing, so you can argue it's just kind of a bit like a browser extension, but I feel like it's always been under YouTube prerogative that they could stamp down on it if they really wanted to. And yeah, it doesn't block ads or whatever, but it is diverting people away from Google official properties for a Google service. So I don't think you can be like super mad that they've decided to put the ban hammer down there, but obviously it's a bit unfortunate because Google does not make a Vision OS YouTube app.
That's the charitable read on this is that Google is cracking down on Juno because they have their own Vision Pro app coming. Yes. I do not think that's the case, unfortunately. It's just funny to see Google do this when you know the market of people using Juno on their Apple Vision Pro is just so small because the Vision Pro market itself is so small. The market of people willing to pay $5 or whatever it was to use Juno is a subset of that. The people who paid the app and actually use their Vision Pro every day, a subset of that. Like, it's got to be maybe in the hundreds of people every day using Juno on their Vision Pro. I just don't understand why Google would pick this battle. And there are, we should point out, other similar, not as good, but similar YouTube wrappers on the Vision OS App Store that are still available as of right now. They just aren't as big as Juno. So that's why they haven't faced the wrath of Google yet.
Yeah, there's one called VisionTube, which basically tries to do the same thing, but a nicer, pretty UI around the YouTube website.
There's also a Safari extension called Enhanced Player.
Mm.
And how it works is you use YouTube just through Safari like you would anywhere, and it replaces the YouTube video player with the native Vision OS video player with a much better design, much easier controls, because that's the thing about using YouTube.com, right? It's the controls like pop, like on a computer, right? You mouse over the video, the controls
the
pop
hover
up.
State, yeah.
Yeah, and they go away. That is not a pleasant experience on Vision Pro whatsoever.
And you have a really small progress bar to target with your eye and yes. Whatever. Yeah.
The Enhanced Player Safari extension replaces all of that and makes it a lot better.
And even Vision OS 2 kind of had, Apple kind of offered some mitigation.
Kind of, yeah.
Sort of, right? Because you can, you like, this is on all platforms where you can go to like YouTube or any website and you can do the new like video viewer thing, right? Where it like pops out the current video player in like a full screen experience. And if you switch a different tab, it automatically puts in picture in picture. That exists now on Vision OS 2. And that popped out like video viewer can be taken into environment or whatever and seen on its own. So, mm-hmm. You know, obviously it's nowhere near as good as if it was an actual native YouTube app, but it's at least better than how it shipped in Vision OS 1.0.
Ultimately, Juno being removed from the App Store, I think, is a pretty big loss to the Vision OS ecosystem that's already kind of floundering. It was one of the best examples of a third-party app, and now it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, if I was Google, if I was the decision maker here, I'd be like, let's just let them get away with it until we have our own app ready to come out. Or tell, like, Christian, like, if you want to do it for fun, that's fine, but you can't make money off of it. Because you can kind of see, like, if you made a service that was, you know, popular, and then someone else was basically just reselling your service with a slightly different skin over the top, you'd be mad about it too. So, like, I do get it, but, like, at least have your own solution available before you crack down on all the, you know, gray area clones, as it were.
Bloomberg has a couple details on what to expect from Apple in early 2025. So first, we have a new iPhone SE, and we've talked about this quite a bit over the past 18 months or so. The new iPhone SE will be based on the iPhone 14 industrial design, so it'll ditch the home button, the big forehead, the big chin, in favor of Face ID with a notch cutout, so not a dynamic island, but a notch. OLED display, only one rear camera. And the big thing here, A18 chip, so the latest generation Apple Silicon. And that, of course, means it'll support Apple Intelligence. My biggest question here and the biggest unknown is pricing, because the current iPhone SE has always been a little bit overpriced, I think, at $429. And if you're getting an iPhone 14 style design with an A18 chip, Face ID, my gut feeling is Apple's going to increase that price again.
It does feel like you're going to get a lot of value at the same price point. On the other hand, there are plenty of Android phones that have OLED screens and full layouts that are way cheaper. So
yeah.
I guess they could get away with it if they want to, but this is Apple, right? Like, they have a brand to protect, they have profit margin to protect. Let's put it this way, it doesn't seem like it's going to get cheaper.
Yeah.
It's not going to return to the $399 price point that the original iPhone SE launched at, which I think was just at the start of the pandemic, was it? Or at least that was the first. No, that was the, so the second gen was 2020. The first gen was earlier still than that. So what we currently have is the third gen iPhone SE, which
yes,
is basically
sorry.
The same as the second gen, but it added 5G. Yeah.
So we're waiting on the iPhone SE 4. Is what's coming in early 2025.
And it's basically going to be like an iPhone 14 in design, except it only have one rear camera. Otherwise, it will look about the same. It's going to have OLED screen. It will have the A18 chip, so you get the latest processor. Come in definitely under $500. Hopefully, they can maintain the same current price of $429. And when that ships, that will be the last home button gone.
Yes.
Right? Because mm-hmm. Apple then sells no other products with home buttons.
If you look at the iPhone lineup right now, you have the iPhone SE 3 at $429. Then the iPhone 14 starts at $599. So I guess, I mean, that's a bigger difference than I remembered between the SE and the lowest end, oldest iPhone that Apple still sells. But with the iPhone 14, what, you don't get the newest chip. The iPhone 14 has the two-year-old chip inside, but you get two cameras. It's an interesting calculus if you're buying, and if you're looking at the lowest end iPhones. I think for most people, though, the iPhone SE would be the better option for longevity's sake. and Apple Intelligence if you care about that. But I don't know. It's the difference there being $170 right now doesn't bode well for them not increasing the iPhone SE price. They could easily increase it to $499 and probably get away with it with the Apple Intelligence angle.
Yeah, and the SE especially already has such locale specific pricing. So like whatever the US price is, it's on like way more discounts in other countries where they can get away with it. Because in like in India, it's not actually that much cheaper, but it is like it is cheaper, but then Apple has to put on like 30% of fees on top because of the import taxes. So like the actual price of the device is cheaper, but then it gets bumped up again because of the import problems. But they've now started producing iPhones domestically and it helps them get around some of those extra tariffs. So they're trying to push the price down. But yeah, the US price does not necessarily reflect the price of the iPhone SE overseas because it's always on sale. They use it as the, you know, the entry-level model for emerging markets and stuff. So and remember, the iPhone 14, they could even stop selling it if they really wanted to. Like, they have to keep selling it. The iPhone 14 has Lightning, right?
That's what I was going to say, yeah. So you'd also be getting USB-C if you get an iPhone SE.
And if you want to make the EU happy, you could stop selling the iPhone 14 at the end of the year.
If you want to make the EU happy, but I don't
think... Yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily Apple's objective.
No, it's quite the opposite. But
yeah, they can drop the 14 out of the lineup if it crunched over it too much.
Well, if they take the 14 out of the lineup, then you're just asking for the iPhone SE to get even more expensive. So
that's what I mean, right? Like, if the SE's going to $499, then they could easily drop the 14 if they have to. But people will buy it because of the 14, and it sounds like this is like the difference between MacBook Air and MacBook Pro. There's some people who just buy the, even if that's the amount of money they've got, they'll buy the 14 over the SE just because it's got the better like brand to it, right? Yeah. And it looks cooler, and it'll probably have nicer colors and it has two cameras. Although if you go on the SE train for a little bit, you can prepare yourself for the iPhone 17 Slim.
That's
which
true.
It's going one camera only.
One camera.
Get on that lifestyle now. Be ready for it.
Then Bloomberg also says coming in early 2025 is an iPad Air update. Apple just released the M2 iPad Air in May? And we're already talking about another iPad Air update, presumably with the M3, I'm guessing.
No, they're not going to do M3 on anything anymore.
Oh, that's right.
The M3 and the A17 Pro are dead.
Yeah.
Because they're first generation 5 nanometer.
That's right.
So if they are going to bump it, it would be to the M4?
Same as the iPad Pro, which is odd. Yeah. Interesting.
Specifically, German's report does not say what chip the iPad Air will get. He just says it focused on internal improvements and come with new keyboard accessories. So maybe that stays on an M2 chip, you know, like they could just, maybe it's an iPad Air with M2 and just more RAM in it so they can have a bit more longevity for future Apple Intelligence features or something. Like it doesn't necessarily have to go all the way to M4. I think it's really unlikely that they do an M3.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Because
I forgot about that.
Because of the fabrication problems. So it might just be another M2 iPad Air and they're just using an excuse to update the keyboard accessories, right? And they can have a slightly more feature-rich keyboard with a function row, bigger trackpad like the iPad Pro. Who knows if they'll make it aluminium like the iPad Pro one. But because it's coming so soon after the last iPad Air update, I wouldn't expect much in terms of differences.
Because Apple's goal for both the rest of this year and early next year is to get all of the Macs on the M4 chip, right? Even the ones that have the M3 right now, and then especially the ones that still have the M2, like the Mac Studio and the Mac Pro and the Mac Mini. I could see a world where the iPad Air goes to M4 early next year, and then we don't see a new iPad Pro until at earliest the end of next year, maybe not even till the beginning of... What year is that? 2026?
Yeah, early 2026.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, 2026.
I mean, that is about 18... Like, what would 18 months be from May? I guess that would be the end of 25, right? So, late 25, early 26. They could swing it.
Then, of course, new iPad Air and iPhone SE in early 2025. Then, still before the end of this year, we're expecting the M4 Mac Mini, the M4 iMac, and the M4 MacBook Pro. And maybe updates.
We expect the iPad Mini to go to A18, right?
Probably, yeah.
Maybe they're just going to do it with the iPad Air. They're just going to not do M4. They'll just put it back on A18. I mean, what's the difference practically, right? Like,
it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that the iPad Air is on an M series chip in retrospect. Yeah.
They don't gain very much from it. I mean, so I think they could just drop it back to A18 if they want to make the lineup cleaner.
Yeah.
Or they could put it on M4 and just be like, well, now it's got the same chip. I tell you what, when I was in the Apple Store, when I had my when I went for the Batsy briefing, I went to the Batsy Apple Store at the same time. Mm-hmm. I was just like perusing, because at the time the iPad Pro was still newer, right? So I was looking at the iPad Pro. The go-to line of the sales reps, when were people looking at iPad Airs, they were like, this has the same chip as our laptops.
Like, oh, yeah.
They said that over and over again. And I guess they can't say that if they put an A18 back in it.
Finally this week, some more on the Apple Card drama that has been ongoing for the past year or so. Goldman Sachs wants out of the Apple Card partnership with Apple. We heard that Apple sent a proposal to Goldman Sachs to exit the partnership within 12 to 18 months. And that was around this time last year. A couple different names had been thrown around. American Express, Synchrony Financial, and Capital One have all been mentioned in the past. But the Wall Street Journal now reports that Apple has held talks with JPMorgan Chase most recently. Those talks are said to have started earlier this year and have advanced in recent weeks. Wall Street Journal says, however, that a deal could still be months away, and key details, including the price, are still to be negotiated.
So which means the price at which they will buy the debt from.
Correct, yes.
Goldman Sachs.
Because right now,
how much debt does it say they've got? Like $20 billion or something?
Apple Card has $17 billion in outstanding balances across 12 million users, and JPMorgan Chase wants to pay less than the full face value of those balances.
Obvious. I mean, they have the upper hand in these negotiations. Goldman Sachs wants to leave. They want to get a deal out of them. They're not just going to buy it one-to-one for no reason. They're going to obviously negotiate to push the price down. I'm sure Apple is involved in those conversations too, because Apple doesn't want to be working with a partner that doesn't want to make the card, even if they've got a contract for it. So Apple will squeeze Goldman Sachs to make a good deal, basically, to give it to somebody else.
And Apple has the final say in all of this. Goldman can spend all of their time negotiating a deal with someone, and then Apple can swoop in at the 11th hour and say, no, we don't like that. Try again. That's how much power Apple has in these negotiations.
Yeah, because the Goldman Sachs arrangement is not only just about the financials, it's also about like the terms of all the services that are offered, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that Apple really pushed with the Apple Card is like transparency and financial and easy to understand financials. And one of the things under that umbrella was they made it so all Apple Card statements come out on the first day of each calendar month, which is really rare. Like almost every other card maker will spread out the publishing of statements for their customers across the month, so you don't get a customer support burden of everybody needing to pay their bill at the same time. Apple wanted to make it easy to the user by saying, look, we'll just do it on the first day of the month, blah, 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 blah. That actually caused issues for Goldman Sachs because they would get overloaded with support problems and their systems would go down in the first thing and they didn't have enough staff on call to be able to handle it. And this is apparently such an important point that Chase is pushing back and saying, look, if we're going to make this deal happen, we need flexibility from Apple that we don't want to publish statements on the first day of the month anymore. We want to spread it out like a more traditional card. And apparently Apple is okay with that concession. This just shows that the deal that Apple struck with Goldman Sachs was really good for them. For Apple in terms of the negotiations. Now Goldman Sachs wants out. The new player is going to take it over. Goldman Sachs somehow has to provide services through the length of the contract, which they bizarrely renewed through 2029, didn't they? End of 22 and they announced they'd renewed the contract to 2029, even though they wanted out of it. So it was a bit of a bizarre mess. But they have to provide those services till then. But obviously they want to get out sooner than that. Chase is like, we'll maybe take it, but we want to be able to change the terms slightly. And that only comes down to Apple agreeing. So will the makeup of the Apple Card product change dramatically? Apple's going to try its hardest not for that not to happen, but they're obviously open to some negotiation, like dropping the requirement to have first day of the month statements.
I have a hard time believing whoever takes over Apple Card is only going to want to change that one thing. The other thing that any new partner is going to want is access to more customer data, right? More information about what people are buying, where they're buying it, because nowadays that is such a crucial part to any credit card business. The other aspect to this, too, is Apple Card savings account. If JPMorgan Chase takes over Apple Card and by extension takes over Apple Card savings account, there is no way that they're going to offer the 4.25% APY that Apple Card savings account offers. None of the big banks in the United States offer anything close to that. I think Chase, for their savings account, is like 0.1% or something, the big banks just don't offer high yield savings accounts. So either Apple Card savings account is about to get significantly less useful, go away entirely, or I could see a scenario where Apple Card goes to, say, JP Morgan Chase, and Apple Card savings account goes somewhere separately. Yeah, or stays with Goldman.
Apple Pay Cash is still, what, Green Dot Bank, isn't it?
Green Dot, yeah.
Over. Yeah. I mean, if I'm Apple, I feel like I could take over the savings directly if I really had to, you know? Like,
yeah.
The risk is in loans, right? Like, an interest accruing savings account is pretty low risk when you've got that much of it. So if it really came down to it, they could take it on themselves if they really had to. But they obviously don't want to. It's much better if they just let some other person do the dirty work. The other thing I will say about savings accounts, though, is that obviously over time, interest rate, base rates are going down anyway. So those high yield accounts are not going to stay at 4.25 forever. They'll be down to 3 and 2, and they would trail off even if it was staying with Goldman Sachs. So
I will say all of this is made more interesting by Apple getting out of Apple Pay Later and shutting down that service. I feel like that decision kind of erased any hope that I had or any prediction that I had about Apple itself taking over more of the financial products that it offers, right? There's clearly some sort of internal shift where they don't want to do that. We've heard Mark Gurman talk about what Project Breakout or whatever to bring more of their financial services in-house, but that was like 2 years ago at this point. And whether Apple's shift in strategy is just they decided it wouldn't be as lucrative as they thought it would be. They're concerned about regulatory pressure, about entering the financial space and dominating another industry. I think it's clear.
And to be clear, Apple Pay Later was out of the Project Breakout theme because the loans and Apple Pay Later were on Apple's books.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like their first step in that direction. And it seems like they've obviously been cagey about it, but it seems like Pay Later was cancelled, not because they were like losing a lot of money on it, but it was more just like regulatory oversight they didn't want to deal with. Maybe there's other parts of the financial system that have better regulation, but you're always going to hit the monopoly problem. I don't know what market Apple can break into that doesn't have a monopoly issue, though, like in terms of competition, because whatever, they're too big that any venture they try is always going to hit those bars. I guess they just have to pick and choose which ones they can be bothered to fight, right? And maybe financial services have been put to the back burner a bit more.
Especially a credit card that's losing billions and billions of dollars. Apple's not chomping at the bit to take that business over, probably. Lose money and face regulatory pressure. Not a great business to be in.
You use Apple Card, right?
Yeah, all the time. Well, not all the time, but for all of my Apple purchases.
Because the Apple purchases, you get 3%.
Yes, yeah. 3%. There was
What year was it when they gave you 6? It was like Christmas, wasn't it?
I think it was the very first year, 2019, I think, 6%.
Yes, because people bought Mac Pros with it, the 2019 Mac Pro.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... They must have lost so much.
There's a reason that promo never came back. I think it did. It came back the next year, I think. And then Apple or Goldman Sachs or whoever was like, no, that's a mistake. It's not supposed to be 6%. It's supposed to be 3%. We screwed up. So yeah, they had no intention on ever bringing that promo back. But that was crazy lucrative, though. 6%.
From doing literally nothing.
Yeah. The other thing that'll be interesting seeing... Say JP Morgan Chase takes over Apple Card. Will it stay as just a cash back card? Because right now, for some people, that's the best thing about Apple Card, right? You spend the money, you instantly get the cash back. For other people, it's one of the limitations of Apple Card, where they would rather have Ultimate Rewards points from Chase, Amex points, or whatever, as another alternative option to pure cash back.
But like, Apple's whole pitch for it was that we don't have any confusion of points and, you know, you don't have to convert anything. It's literally just money in your account the next day. It's very simple. So if they went to points, I feel like that would undermine some of the point of it.
But is it a better deal for JP Morgan Chase to have that option to have Ultimate Rewards points? I don't know how the financials on that break down.
Well, I guess maybe Apple would be more inclined. I feel like Apple, if they could only do points, I feel like Apple would be more inclined to step away and just really like, we'll transfer you to a JP Morgan card, but we're not going to brand Apple Card anymore and we're going to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
Hopefully they get a good outcome because obviously there are ways to get better deals on credit cards, but the overall offering where you have like a card with no fees on it that is very transparent and open and you know, it's very clear what rewards you're getting and you don't have to do any complications and you can go abroad and there's no, you know, fees or there's no hidden charges. There's no charges apart from interest, right? Like It's a really nice appeal, and it makes like the Apple Card fit the brand really well. And to date, there's been some minor niggles with, like, you know, people having their savings accounts locked and stuff. But overall, I feel like Apple has got huge positives out of the Apple Card publicly facing, right? Like,
oh yeah,
relatively little complaints and pushback for a great product they can offer with their brand on it. And all of the bad stuff about it is on Goldman Sachs' accounts, right? Not theirs. If this is the point where maybe the Apple, you know, gets punished for it, if they can't smoothly transition to a different provider. But up to now, they've actually got away with it. And so we'll see how this shakes down. But at least for the last 5 years, you know, Apple has only, I'd say, benefited from the Apple Card. It hasn't been a negative. The only negative has been on Goldman Sachs' side.
I mean, for Apple, it's another way for people to buy Apple products and not pay the full price up front.
And it binds you to the iPhone, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, I think that does it for this week. You can find an ad-free version of the show with bonus content each and every week at 95mac.com/join for $5 a month or $50 a year. This week, Mayo's been having some trouble with his routers, and he's apparently going to bemoan the loss of the airport routers and tell us what he's doing instead.
Or at least at least remember the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating and a review. Send us feedback, happyhour@95mac.com. I am on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, at Chance H. Miller. And Mayo, what about you?
At BZMAA.
All right. Thanks, Mayo.